United States v. Brown.
May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant David Jankowski, and I represent the appellant, M.A. 1 Brown. Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, I request 2 minutes of my time be reserved for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appearances matter at trial. Jurisdictions that allow witness attendance allow them for children, and for good reason. The accommodation is reasonable, after all, under the right circumstances. But, Your Honors, this was not one of them. A.W. was not a child when she testified. Seating her advocate next to her, then, was an inherently prejudicial accommodation. Now, if this court disagrees, it should still set aside the findings and the sentence. The age of A.W., her relationship to her advocate, and the sounding of the advocate bell in the courtroom before the members eroded M.A. 1 Brown's presumption of innocence and denied him his right to a fair trial.
Is this structural error?
No, Your Honor. And structural error is different than the close judicial scrutiny required in this case. An accommodation that is inherently prejudicial could still be saved under Holbrook and Depp v. Missouri if the state demonstrates an essential interest. But here, no essential interest was identified. Indeed, the military judge not once even asked the government to show good cause. The states recognized the danger of an accommodation like this one. That's why in Connecticut, for example, compelling need is required, and that's only after the state demonstrates by clear and convincing evidence that the accommodation...
Well, is the nub of your objection that the judge didn't make findings and conclusions?
Your Honor, that's the nub of our objection under the inherent prejudicial analysis. However, under the actual prejudicial analysis, Your Honors, M.A. 1 Brown was still prejudiced here, and that's because of the age of A.W., which in State v. Suga, the Hawaii Supreme Court noted, was at its apex. She was nearly 18 years old when she testified. And this court should look to that decision.
Yeah, isn't that the case where the person put her hands on her shoulders?
Yes, Your Honor, that is that case.
Okay, and is there any evidence of record that there was any touching, any exchange of words, any significant looks between this person and A.W.?
No, Your Honor, there is not any...
So basically she sat up there.
She sat there, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, and what you're saying is that's inherently prejudicial because...
Because for one reason, Your Honor, in allowing the accommodation, the military judge essentially stamped preferred status on A.W.
But wouldn't that be true in every case, in which case the age wouldn't matter? Right, you're saying that in every case, it's a stamp of approval. And your argument in this case is that the reason it was really bad here is because she was 17 and not a child. But what you're saying, or your reason you're saying that it's bad, is because it's a stamp of approval.
That's certainly one reason, Your Honor. And it is a reason that is a common thread in all the other, in the state cases. And appellant's argument that this is inherently prejudicial makes sense because the states wouldn't allow this accommodation without finding such high standards of compelling need or substantial necessity.
Which states require a compelling need other than Connecticut?
Compelling necessity is required in the state of Hawaii, and substantial need is required in New Jersey. And in New Jersey, that's only after a balancing of a number of factors, Senior Judge Efron. So here, the military judge never balanced any factors, nor did he make any findings of need. He simply made observations the day after an overnight recess that the victim was crying.
I think he didn't just say she was crying, right? He said she was incomprehensible.
Yes, Your Honor, he did say that she was crying. I believe the words were unintelligibly. But as State v. Suka notes, the mere fact that crying occurs is not enough to go from 0 to 60 miles per hour and allow a victim advocate to sit next to the witness.
Counsel, go ahead.
Can I step you back for a second?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is this or is this not a 611 case?
Your Honor, this court's analysis should not stop at 611 Alpha. Certainly 611 Alpha is relevant to this court's inquiry, But notably, both New Jersey and Hawaii have verbatim the same rule that military courts have, and that's the rule that's modeled after the federal rule of evidence, which allows a trial judge essentially to avoid needless consumption of time.
Okay, so you're so, I take it that's a yes, but yes. Now let's talk about the factors that should be considered.
Yes, Your Honor, it's yes, but not.
If it's not 611, what principle of law, what rule of procedure or principle should the military judge be following before you fill it in?
Yes, Your Honor. So 2 points there. First, 611.
I'm trying to figure out even just what book to pull out before we start talking.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, certainly the state law reporters are relevant to this court's analysis because...
Well, hang on. I'm asking you what rule or procedure you should follow or rule of evidence, and you're telling me to pull out Connecticut state law?
No, Your Honor, not
in a court-martial?
Certainly not just Connecticut, but in United States v. Romy, this court's predecessor cited footnote 1 of State v. Suka, the Hawaii case that appellant does rely on.
Right, but you're not really answering my question, which is your answer 611, but he should look to state law to inform how he applies it, or is your answer he should apply state law and I'll choose which state law in the context of my case?
The former, Chief Judge Baker, certainly the former. 611 Alpha is an appropriate starting point for this court,
okay,
as we do not have a governing statute or rule. Under 611 Alpha, however...
Now we get to thresholds and process.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're not satisfied with either the judge's process or the threshold, if any, that was applied. Is that fair to say?
That is precisely fair, Chief Judge Baker, yes.
And you're drawing the threshold and process from state law, but it need not come from a particular state. It's just that, in your view, you're not satisfied that the appropriate threshold, be it compelling or substantial interest or process, some sort of finding, was followed.
Yes, Your Honor. And even under our own case law, United States v. Romy, where an 8-year-old sat next to a mother, this court did contrast that situation with what happened in State v. Suka, where a 15-year-old sat next to her victim advocate. But under United States v. Collier, this court's case in the year 2000, this court found that a military judge abused his discretion. After ostensibly relying upon 611 Alpha, the military judge failed to find any factors under that rule's subsection. So here, the military judge did just that. He did not find that AW faced undue harassment or fear from interrogation from the defense counsel. He did not find that this accommodation was necessary for the needless consumption of time, and he did not rely on 611 Alpha subsection 1, which would give him the authority to pursue the ascertainment of truth. He made no such findings, and not once did he require trial counsel to advance a rule or cite to any statute or case law in making this visible and significant accommodation.
Counsel, to return to state law, you've cited several cases which have states that have required specific findings. There are other states, including ones cited in your brief, for example, New Hampshire in the LaTendra case, and most recently, the state of Kansas in the Rochelle case, which was decided last month, citing LaTendra, which have specifically rejected following the New Jersey and the Connecticut rules. Why should we follow one set of cases and not the other? That is, I didn't see in your briefs or your reply a discussion of those cases that have gone the other way.
Senior Judge Efron, this court should look to those specific states that are cited in appellant's brief, specifically New Jersey and Hawaii, because this court essentially looked to those decisions in United States v. Romy. There were a number of factors identified in Romy. For example, whether or not the accommodation was done in a neutral fashion. Here, it was not done in a neutral fashion because the military judge never even required trial counsel to advance any argument at all in support of it. And additionally, Your Honor, when the military judge instructed the members on this accommodation, he noted that this was an accommodation that, quote, I have made. In State v. Dela Cruz, a Minnesota case that's in our joint appendix, I believe at page 12, there the military judge also, or excuse me, the state trial judge instructed jurors, and not once did he say that this was an accommodation that the court specifically has made. And indeed, in that case, the judge there told the members that he's given specific instructions to the advocate or to that attendant.
Counsel, do you agree that, well, let me put it a different way. What's the standard for closing the courtroom?
I believe, Your Honor, it's a demonstration of compelling need under ABC v. Powell, I believe, is the relevant case. But forgive me, Your Honor, I'm not terribly articulate with that.
And you'd agree that when we've had that standard not met, that it's structural error in the Supreme Court case law, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what are we to make of the fact that the defense counsel in this case, his alternative was to close the courtroom? And the military judge correctly said, no, we're not anywhere near that.
Your Honor, this court really shouldn't make much of that at all, because another accommodation that he did request specifically was to allow the victim advocate to sit in the front row. And that's a factor that was identified in State v. TE under its logistics prompt.
Does that convert this into a case about front row versus sitting next to the witness?
Not solely, Your Honor.
What else is in play? Because as I understand the briefs and the record, the attendant did all the things the judge said, or didn't do all the things the judge said not to do, like touch, nod, and so on. So what's in play other than if the defense counsel was happy to have him sit in the front row, and instead they sat next to the witness? That's the whole case, right? What's missing?
No, Your Honor. So one other point on the inferences from the record. As is noted in State v. Rulana, another Hawaii Supreme Court case, communication is not always verbal, and by definition, it's not always physical either. So there could have been times...
You said could have. Does the record reflect that they did not follow the judge's ruling?
It does not, Your Honor. But then to go to your Honor's question directly, had the victim advocate been placed in the front row of the gallery, presumably then the military judge would not have sounded that advocate bell and told the members that, in fact, this is her advocate, she's seated in the front row. It would have been enough under that placement to allow AW to see her advocate and to have comfort as a result.
Well, are you taking an exception to the fact that he said the word advocate, or that she sat there, or a combination of the two? If he had simply said, plop her there, and said nothing to the members about who she was or why she was there, would it have been free from error?
No, Judge Stuckey, and in fact, it is a combination of the two, but it's also looking at the title of Ms. DeWeese. She's a victim advocate, and footnote one of State v. Suka, the footnote that this court's predecessor relied upon in United States v. Romy, it notes that a support person or a person who is a professional witness counselor, like the one we had here, is one who's most likely to have greatest potential prejudice. Rather, it's advisable to have a mother or a close family.
Well, now that's an interesting point. Which way does it cut that this person is a professional and not a member of the family?
It cuts in favor of appellant, Your Honor.
Well, does it? If you had mom up there, isn't that a living refutation? Isn't that mom saying, he did it, and I'm willing to go through this court-martial, and I'm willing to forfeit his retired pay because of what he did to my kid? Are you sure it cuts that way?
Yes, Your Honor, and fortunately, I have both Hawaii and New Jersey on my side there. Both those courts recognize that members would discount the familial loyalty of a mother or a father.
Well, it's hardly the same situation in a court-martial.
Sure, Your Honor, but those states do have the same rule of evidence that would guide the military judge here, and that's 611 Alpha. So we can look to those states, and that's what this court's predecessor...
Isn't 611A primarily aspirational? The guts of that rule is 611D that everybody agrees doesn't apply.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and in fact, the military judge stated that we're nowhere near the prerequisites to make a finding under remote to allow such an accommodation.
Well, as it turned out, it was an error of law. She wasn't eligible for it anyway because she was over 16.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and in our system, the military courts do define a child as being under the age of 16. Yet all the courts that allow this accommodation do so for children, and that's because of a good policy reason.
That's fine. Where's the prejudice here? Assuming the judge erred by not making findings and conclusions and lay it on the record who she was, why she was up there. Where's the prejudice?
Your Honor, the prejudice is most exemplified by the findings here, and in fact, the disparate findings. So we have A.W. who testified alongside her advocate. She formed the basis of 8 offenses that were leveled against MA1 Brown. The government achieved 6 out of 8 convictions for those 8 specifications. Yet MB, her half-sister, who also testified to similar allegations forming the basis of 6 offenses, was only able to achieve 2 out of 6 convictions. Of course, she did not have the victim advocate by her side. And indeed, it's telling that the government essentially concedes in its brief, I believe at page 31, that without this accommodation, if we take them at their word, that without this accommodation, she wouldn't have been able to testify. So without that, then...
Well, that's post hoc ergo propter hoc. She was there, therefore, that's the reason.
And counsel, I think that's not a correct statement, right? Because if she had been remained unable to testify in this way, I mean, the military judge could have come up with another accommodation and one that might have been more prejudicial to your client. So let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we're not going to agree with you, all right? And I'm not expecting you to concede that we're not going to agree with you, and I don't know if we will or if we won't, but assuming that we didn't, what do you think the rule should be? What should the test be before this is permissible?
Judge Ryan, the test should
don't
be...
Don't spout state law. Just tell me the rule.
Yes, Your Honor. So the test should be a finding similar to what we have in Military Rule of Evidence 611 Delta. And that's because of the unfair likelihood of bolstering and vouching for credibility when you place an attendant next to a witness.
But, I mean, 611D has nothing to do with vouching, right? It has to do with the fact that they're being denied the right to confront the witnesses against them.
That's a correct statement, Your Honor, but what it also does is allow for an accommodation when a child is unable to testify in court due to some fear or embarrassment. So certainly that's one factor that this court could look to. It could also look to the age of the witness. It doesn't have to stop at the age of 16. This court could pick the age of 18, for example, but it should note that the policy reasons that would govern an accommodation like this one wouldn't as readily apply to someone who's at the age of 18, because at that point, they're not a child of tender years who's emotionally fragile and naturally going to be intimidated by the black robes of the judge or the number of members seated in the jury box. So age should be another factor that this court should look to. And certainly, at minimum, the military judge should ask the government to state reasons for the accommodation. Here, that simply never happened. We have AW crying on the stand, and then we have the military judge stating almost immediately, I'm willing to do anything. I'm willing to adjust anything to make this to help you testify. And then we go right to the government stating, well, we would like the victim advocate to sit next to her. But not once did the military judge even ask AW if that's in fact a necessary accommodation. And that should be another factor, Your Honors, that this court should look to. Did the military judge ask AW or the witness to do that? And that's what happened in Romy, at least. The military judge there asked the 8-year-old whether or not she needed her mother there to testify. Chief Judge Baker, I see my time has expired.
Okay, may I go ahead. Follow with a couple, maybe better to get out before rebuttal. Following up on our earlier discussion with respect to state law, you identified reasons why certain states should not be followed, not because of the elements of those state laws, but you cited 2 separate aspects. First, you identified things that happened in this case which may or may not be prejudicial. And secondly, you cited our case in Romy with respect to the citation in Stuka. Putting aside what specifically happened in this case, my question goes to why shouldn't we be open to considering the approach of Kansas and New Hampshire, which do not have a laundry list of requirements, but instead trust to the discretion of the judge? And my second question is, with respect to Romy and its citation of Stuka, is that any precedent that binds us? After all, in Romy, it is a simple CF site, and we don't have to get into the mechanics of blue booking here unless you'd like to, but does that really bind us as a matter of precedent that would preclude us from following either the New Hampshire or Kansas approach that largely relies on the discretion of the judge without a laundry list?
And Senior Judge Efron, I'm happy to either answer that question now or in rebuttal.
No, I think Senior Judge Efron wanted you to answer it now.
All right, thank you, Chief Judge.
In a succinct manner.
Yes, Your Honor. Why not follow those states? To Your Honor's first question, if appellant is correct, both Kansas and New Hampshire have governing statutes that would apply. And here, Congress has not applied a statute to courts martial that would allow this accommodation. Now, certainly the lower court and the government in its brief cites to 18 U.S.C. 3509I. But as Your Honor's opinion for the court in the United States v. McElhaney stated, that statute simply does not apply to courts martial. So,
I don't believe that's what that case said. My recollection is what the case said was that the double jeopardy, the statute of limitations provisions that were at issue from federal civilian law could not apply in courts martial because there was an express provision in military law that Congress had not overridden.
Why don't you address that on rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Refresh yourself on it and then address it on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Major General Roberts, along with Colonel Stephen Newman. I represent the United States. This Court should affirm the lower court's decision for two reasons. First, the military judge did not abuse his discretion because the accommodation here was reasonable and not arbitrary under RCM 801, Military Rule of Evidence 611, and did not violate a counsel's right to due process. And second, any error was not constitutional and did not prejudice appellant because Ms. DeWeese's presence had no impact on the trial, was properly controlled by the military judge's instructions, and did not contribute to appellant's conviction. There is no requirement in statute, regulation, or case law that the military judge make a finding of necessity prior to making any kind of accommodation under Military Rule of Evidence 611.
In the context of a case like this, should we give more or less deference to a judge that nonetheless does so?
This court should give the military judge the same deference that this court gives in any other 611A context. That is broad discretion, and the military and federal appellate courts are complete accord.
Okay. Should they give broader discretion where a judge does try, where a judge puts their reasoning on the record versus not?
You can
start with broad, but what I'm trying to say is, does it matter then if a military judge puts their reasoning on the record?
Well, it goes without saying, Your Honor, that a military judge's decision carries more weight the more justifications are put on the record.
In your view, did the military judge do so in this case?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. The military judge made several observations that show that his decision was reasonable and not arbitrary. Going to the reasonableness prong of that analysis, the military judge's determination here was justified by the circumstances. He noted on the record that AW was crying during her testimony. The record is plain that she bursts into tears. The military judge noted after taking a break that AW was not even able to look at him during the subsequent colloquy and could only answer with gestures. And finally, the military judge did note on the record prior to bringing the member back in the following day that she was completely unintelligible and unable to talk because she was crying.
Was that something that he observed with respect to the day of the testimony?
During the previous day, yes, Your Honor.
What specifically did he observe on the day that this 17-year-old was going to testify before the court martial with respect to her behavior, demeanor, or ability to testify on that day?
After the overnight recess, there's no observation to that regard.
Well, if there is no observation, putting aside the question of whether a standard of necessity should apply, is there any state law decision that you could cite that allows a judge to permit an accommodation of this nature when there's no showing whatsoever under the lowest possible standard that there's a problem with the witness testifying?
No, Your Honor. There's no state law on point.
Federal law?
And no federal precedent. However, The absence of federal precedent is explained by the fact that there is a federal statute, as appellant knows, that expressly, not only expressly authorizes this type of accommodation, but vests a statutory right in a child witness in this type of trial to have an adult attendant.
So in your view, under 3509I, there's no showing that's needed. Simply in any case in which a child testifies, how does the judge determine under 3509I? Does the judge just do it in every case? Does the judge decide on a case by case, and what's the basis?
Well, again, Your Honor, that decision is commended to the discretion of the trial judge in federal courts by the statute, and it's proven relatively uncontroversial. And we can point to no case law that has restricted that discretion.
And what's the government's view as to the application of 3509I in courts martial?
It's persuasive authority, certainly. It's not intended to directly constrain a military judge's discretion. And it's not intended to directly to apply to courts martial, Your Honor. However, it's persuasive authority and informs this court's decision on two points. First, it informs this court's determination what kind of scrutiny to apply here. There is no due process error here because the same type of process is regularly used in federal courts. And second, it informs this, and most pertinent to the evidentiary issue, it informs this court's determination of the reasonableness of the military judgment.
And did the judge in this case expressly rely on 3509I?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so the appellate court did below.
They did, yes, Your Honor.
Now, if you invite 3509I in, don't you have to invite all of 3509I in, and that includes the videotaping?
No, Your Honor. Because again, as the lower court did, and as this court may, it may use the statute as persuasive authority. And the federal courts, as we cited in our brief, have found that the videotaping requirement, regardless, is not a violation of any constitutional rights and does not vitiate.
Are you citing the Groom case?
Pardon, Your Honor?
The Groom case?
Yes, the Groom case.
Isn't that a plain error case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that wouldn't apply here, would it? Because the judge didn't rely on 3509I at trial.
No, Your Honor.
Counsel, would you agree that the videotaping portion of the statute would be of greater importance in a case where there was allegations that the victim advocate did something that the military judge had told her not to, meaning made gestures, made contact, et cetera, et cetera?
I would agree with that, yes, Your Honor.
What if she were 19? You're talking the judge has broad discretion. Could the judge have done this if she were, exactly same facts? She blubbered. She was unintelligible the previous day, but she's 19. Can the judge do this?
It would, yes.
The judge could do it.
However, it would.
Would he need to make any more findings than he did here?
Likely, yes, Your Honor. However, it would depend on the facts and circumstances and observations in that case. For instance,
I'm saying exactly the same. Okay. She blubbered, she was unintelligible, but she's 19.
Yes, Your Honor.
The judge could do it.
It would be within the military judge's discretion, and it would be evaluated by the courts in the same way as this case is.
Same standard review?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
What other options were available to the military judge?
And yes, Your Honor, the military judge considered three other options. First, took a break, as the witness requested. Went to a 39A, excused the members, and noted during that 39A that the witness was not able to talk, not able to address the military judge directly. And again, as Your Honor noted during appellant's argument, there were two other options that the military judge considered, which were remote testimony and closing the courtroom.
What about front row?
Yes, Your Honor, and that the military judge considered that as well. However, that is essentially no accommodation at all.
Where do we see on the record the military judge considering that?
Well, it was brought to the military judge's attention by the defense counsel, and the military judge rejected that course.
Implicitly rejected it or rejected it expressly?
I implicitly rejected it.
And how do we know it would not have worked?
We don't know. I mean, but however, Your Honor, that is essentially no accommodation at all, because, again, this was a public trial. There was no suggestion that the victim advocate was excluded from the courtroom, and there was no there's nothing on the record to suggest that she was not already in the courtroom. It was a token suggestion at best by the defense counsel. So again, there's certainly no due process error here. An appellant can point to no precedent that suggests that this was a violation of appellant's due process.
Appellant isn't arguing constitutional. I don't think appellant's arguing it's a constitutional error.
If he has conceded that, we accept that concession, Your Honor.
He can talk about it on rebuttal.
Counsel, with respect to 3509, that statute's about 20 years old now?
Approximately, yes, Your Honor.
And within that time, the president, who has the authority to issue rules of procedure and evidence for courts martial under Article 36, so long as the president discerns that they're practical and they're not inconsistent with or contrary to the UCMJ, has not implemented 3509I. Is there anything in the public record that would explain why the president has not done that?
No, Your Honor. However, again, 611 Alpha shows that the president does trust military judges with awesome discretion, with broad discretion, to control the mode of interrogation of witnesses.
I understand your point there from your brief. My question is, do we know why the president has not implemented this? In other words, how do we know that the president hasn't determined that it's impractical to have 3509 in courts martial, for example? The executive branch people looking at this might have looked at it and said, you know what, the only way this works in federal court is if it's tied to a videotape recording. And there's no videotape recording that's easily done in courts martial all over the world, et cetera, so we're not going to have 3509I. How do we know that isn't a determination after 20 years that it's impractical?
We don't, Your Honor, and the president has not made any negative findings to that regard that would inform this court's determination here. Addressing the constitutional argument very briefly, there is no error here. There is no suggestion by appellant that this is the type of error that was found in Taylor v. Kentucky or United States v. Whiteman. United States v. Kaiser that infected the structure, the intrinsic framework of the trial.
How do you respond to the appellant's contention that witness A, with this woman plopped up next to her, did better with the members than witness B, minus the woman?
There's no way to really judge how the members evaluated one versus the other. As appellant notes, there were convictions on appellant's actions with both witnesses, and there were findings of not guilty regarding charges involving both witnesses. What we do know from the record is that, you know, there was no stamp of approval here. In fact, the military judge expressly instructed the members that Mr. Weiss's presence was not intended to be any kind of endorsement by the military judge or the trial counsel or anybody else of the credibility of AW's testimony.
Do you agree that this would be a different case if that instruction had not been given?
It would be, yes, Your Honor. Because that instruction, the other instructions that were given, First of all, they're relevant for two reasons. First, they control the extent of Mr. Weiss's accommodation and presence in the courtroom. And they also properly instructed the jury to control any prejudicial effect that Mr. Weiss's presence would have.
Counsel, returning to 3509, as I understand the government's argument, the government is not arguing here that 3509 is directly applicable to courts martial, but rather it is a source of authority which may or may not be taken into account by this court as persuasive.
Yes, that's right, Your Honor.
Okay. So with respect to 3509, this court could decide, for example, that you have to take the whole package. That is, it only works with the videotaping. The court could decide that we only would require that the accommodation be made by the judge. Or we could decide to follow either the New Jersey, Connecticut approach of requiring necessity, or we could decide to follow the state approaches of the other states that have given more discretion to the judge, but it still requires some sort of determination by the judge as to need. But all those options, I'm not asking you to address either one, but as I understand it, all those options are before the court at this point.
Well, no, Your Honor, and we would encourage the court not to adopt necessarily any of those approaches whole cloth. We have a system here. We have a rule that governs both RCN 801 and Military Rule of Evidence 611 Alpha. And again, the trial judge is trusted, the military judge here is trusted with broad discretion. Now, 3509I is informative to this court, as it was to the lower court, on two counts. First, it counsels that there was no due process error here, because this type of process is regularly practiced in the federal courts. And as the court noted recently in the same term in the United States v. Vasquez, there's no separate military due process above and beyond the canopy of that.
You said that it's regularly processed in the federal courts. There are virtually no decisions on 3509I. And do you have any indication, given the nature of federal jurisdiction, whether there are actually many cases tried in the federal courts under this statute, this procedure?
No, Your Honor, but however, I believe what I said is that it's not proven controversial.
I understand that, but is it not controversial because it's used a lot and it's a regular process in the federal civilian courts, or is it not controversial because this type of case does not appear very often? Do we have any record that would show us one way or another?
Respectfully, Your Honor, given the paucity of case, I don't think there's any way to know.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I think that you said before that you thought that it would be fine to have an advocate sit with someone that was 19. What about someone that was 30?
It would depend on the circumstances. And for instance, let me get
I guess my question is are you aware of any state or federal cases permitting an advocate to sit with someone that was well beyond the age of majority?
I'm not, Your Honor.
Okay, and you don't disagree that to the extent that it's permitted with children, it's based on the perceived legitimate state interest in shielding children, right, from traumatic experiences and making them able to testify?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what would the legitimate state interest be for a 35-year-old to have a victim advocate sit by their side?
Well, again, there would likely have to be some other circumstances that were relevant. For instance, a 35-year-old who was afflicted with Down syndrome or some other intellectual disability who needed to have that sort of assistance to testify. An 80-year-old, for example, who may need assistance from the bailiff to get to the witness stand. These are accommodations that are within the military judge's discretion to make, and insofar as they are reasonable.
I'm just trying to make sure that you're not suggesting that as a wholesale matter that that judges have the discretion to have victim advocates sit next to anyone and anyone.
No, Your Honor.
Why don't you address the question from a that was an age-based factor, now crime-based factor. Does it matter that it was sexual assault? Well, it certainly matters. It's a factor. But what if it were a 17-year-old who had been mugged?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, in general, insofar as 611A is applicable, it would be within the discretion. However, it would be subject to reasonableness and an arbitrariness analysis. And again, all of those circumstances are relevant to the military judge's analysis. And it's the United States' contention that the military judge did put enough on the record here, put enough observations on the record to suggest that the accommodation made here in this case under these circumstances were reasonable.
But you're making two different arguments. One argument is that under 3509, no analysis needs to be given. Judge can just do it. Your other argument is that under these circumstances, it was reasonable and met some level of necessity case. If you, as a general matter, can an accommodation like this be made without putting something on the record?
And to clarify, yes, Your Honor. I mean, if this case happened in federal court, there would be no issue because the federal statute would apply, and there would be no reason for the judge to deviate from that. Here, the federal statute, again, does not control, does not apply directly to the court's martial, and did not guide the military judge's discretion, use of his discretion here.
So under a 611 analysis, which the government's asking for, doesn't there have to be a reason set forth on the record, as opposed to simply saying, this is a 17-year-old, we're going to put a witness attendant up there?
There's no requirement for a necessity determination, and insofar as the circumstances of the case show that the military judge was not unreasonable or arbitrary in the use of his discretion, there was no abuse of discretion, no error. So, in summary, Your Honor, there was no error, and if there was error, there was no constitutional error, there was no prejudice, and we ask that you affirm the decision of the court below.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant. Could you start by addressing the question that Judge Stuckey asked, and rather than have government counsel answer for you, you can answer for yourself as to what your claim is and whether it's founded in constitutional assertion or not.
Thank you, Chief Judge Baker. Yes, it is sounded in constitutional error. The presumption of innocence flows from the liberty that's protected in the Due Process Clause, and that's under this Court's precedent, United States v. Kaiser. To answer Senior Judge Efron's question, appellant is merely relying on the words of McElhaney, where this Court stated the text of 3509 demonstrates congressional intent that it doesn't apply to courts martial. So appellant's main contention here is that it is simply unfair to apply that statute in the piecemeal process here, which is essentially what the government is asking for.
I believe the government's asking not that it be applied as a matter of law to the court-martial, but that it be looked to as persuasive authority, which in many of the cases that you cited, state courts have looked to 3509 as persuasive authority. Is there anything that would preclude us from looking at as persuasive authority? I understand your argument that it shouldn't be, but as a matter of law, are we precluded from looking at 3509I as persuasive authority?
Not as a matter of law, Your Honor. And in fact, if this Court did, it could read the thread that's common in the states, and that's that there are sufficient safeguards that need to be imposed when an accommodation like this one is made. In 3509, Congress included the safeguard of videotaping to prevent prompting.
But you don't disagree that there was no prompting in this case. There was no touching. There was no prompting. There was no objection by the defense counsel at trial on any of those bases.
There was no objection, Your Honor, by defense counsel on those bases. But we do not know whether or not there were glances that were failed to be objected upon, or whether or not there were other nonverbal
The military judge was quite clear as to what would be permitted and what was not permitted, correct?
Appellant would disagree, Your Honor, because in his instructions to Ms. DeWeese on the record, he did state, I'm not trying to discourage you from touching her or prodding her. I'm just saying if that happens, then we'll need to take a break. So there was some lack of clarity in those instructions to
the advocate. Did they take a break?
They did not take a break, Your Honor, but the military judge also did not ask the members if they knew Ms. DeWeese. And two of the members in this case, and this is at Joint Appendix 413 and 423, actually served as victim advocates. Indeed, BMC Coipa was a victim advocate at the time of the trial. Did they know Ms. DeWeese? Would they have then put unfair emphasis?
Was that explored in voir dire?
It was not, Your Honor, but the
There's no IAC claim here.
No, there's not, Your Honor, but there's also no indication from the government that this accommodation would be necessary. Chief Judge Baker, I see that my time has expired.
I have one more question. In Romy, which you keep citing, we let the admittedly younger child whisper to mom, and mom serves the transmitter. Isn't that a good deal more problematic on its face than simply having this professional sit here inertly?
No, Your Honor, it's not, because two significant factors cut against it, and that's the factors that this court identified in its CF site in State v. Suka, the age, which counsels in favor of a finding of prejudice, and then also the title of Ms. DeWeese. And further, this court found in Romy that the military judge there made an implied finding based on trial counsel's representations that this was, in fact, the procedure that was needed to get her to testify. They did that because the military judge even tried to have that 8-year-old answer his own questions. Here, none of that happened.
Implied finding? And you're complaining that we don't have explicit findings here.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I'm not complaining.
No, you don't need to go any further.
Yes, counsel, with respect to your argument on the inherent prejudice of having a 17-year-old testify under these circumstances, is it your view, then, that 3509I is unconstitutional?
No, Your Honor, because it applies only, under appellant's view, only in federal district courts. So we have different jurisdictions here. In the court's martial system, special significance is placed on the age of 16.
I understand your argument on age of 16, but I'm talking about constitutionality. Could the president, could the Congress provide that for military law that is an exact replicate of 3509I, or in the absence of congressional action, could the president apply 3509I as a matter of Article 36 action without violating the Constitution?
Your Honor, no, not in our system, and that's because the Military Rule of Evidence 414 Delta, Military Rule of Evidence 611 Delta, all place special significance on the age of 16. So to say that someone who is mature enough at the age of 16 or is no longer able to have certain accommodations in courts martial now is allowed to at the age of 18 would be cognitively dissonant. Appellant could serve.
Well, what part of the what's the constitutional argument that would preclude the president from doing this under Article 36?
The due process clause, Your Honor. That's appellant would answer the question in that fashion. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. We'll thank counsel for both parties. The case is submitted, and we'll stand in recess until further order of the court.
All right. Stands adjourned until further order of the court.